There's going to be a public debate about you don't have to do all these things with renewables and efficiency because you've got all the fossil fuels, you're going to take all the CO2, you're going to put them in these underground reservoirs. Okay? Now, that's going to be a public debate. Because I'm sure we're going to go through the same thing that we went through with nuclear waste. We're going to have a technical elite that are going to say, no problem, we can take care of it. You're going to have another group over here which is going to say, wait a minute, there's no way you can assure us that that will never get out of there. And we've had some experience with the so-called burps of CO2. There have been lakes in Africa, at least one I know of, that has an overturning and a huge bubble of CO2 came out and killed about 400 people on the shores of the lake. Okay? So the question that's going to be a public debate about is the same question as nuclear waste. How safe is it to store all the CO2 underground? What are the dangers with it? Can earthquakes let go? And all that kind of stuff. You're going to be entering that debate, my guess is, anywhere between 2 to 5 years from now.
Can't that debate be framed centralized, distributed?
You still get CO2. Anytime you burn fossil fuel, you're going to get CO2, period.
But if you plant trees, you start to capture the CO2, right?
You can't plant enough trees to capture the CO2 that this world is putting out on the burning of fossil fuels. No way.
Over long term, could it be fuel cells?
It can be fuel. Well, that's back into the renewable. It can be fuel cells. You can ship to a hydrogen economy. Then the question becomes, how do you make the hydrogen? Okay? If you make the hydrogen by hydrolysis of water, using renewable technology, then you're okay. But if you make the hydrogen by gasification of fossil fuels, you're back into it. So there's a question of how you make the hydrogen and how you get at it. And the fuel cells clearly are going to be coming. It's going to take longer than I think people think it's going to do. Because right now, all fuel cells are operated by reformers. They basically take natural gas and turn natural gas into hydrogen and feed it to the fuel cell. Because we have no hydrogen distribution system. We have not gone to a hydrogen distribution system. One of the real promising aspects of hydrogen is actually biological conversion. Little bugs that give off hydrogen. There's some good work going on. Okay. So I'm going to be done in a minute and I'll just answer questions. How's that? Or I'll make a break. When I look at this whole dynamics, okay, I use this diagram and it gets a little complicated. On top, I got environmental impact. If you want low environmental impact, you move to the left. You don't care, you move to the right. The upper part of it is wholesale, the big stuff, big power plants. The bottom part is retail, the distributed stuff. Right now, most of our, for a century now, we've had the big power plants, the transmission distribution system. That's how you get to it, right? Once you get the gas, use natural gas, there's much smaller natural gas stuff. And in fact, you can visualize small natural gas systems in factories, in homes, where you don't go through the transmission distribution system at all. You make the electricity right there where you use it. All the connection is a gas pipeline. If you go to renewables, you don't even need the gas pipeline. You can either go to large wind farms, or you can go to distributed stuff, like small wind turbines and photovoltaics. And when you do that, you don't need any connection to the house. You can design stuff now that doesn't require you to connect to anybody. So depending on what the price differential is, you move one way or another. Depending on what it costs you to transmit and move the stuff over the wires, you either move up and down. And depending on how much you want to deal with environmental impact, you move one way. If you don't care about environmental impact, then coal generation is actually the best way to go. If you do, you want to move the other way. So this is the dynamic that's now going on in the industry. What are the prices? What is it worth to be clean? How much renewable do you have to do? What does global climate change do? All of these things are in flux. Yeah? Let's hit the wrong button here. Guys are going to teach me how to do this. Okay. Several years ago at PG&E, we did experiments on energy efficiency. And in fact, we had Amory Lovins in. I don't know how many of you know Amory or not. Okay, Amory is a good friend of mine. And we had dinner one night, and Amory said, you know, you can really save 75% of the energy every place. And I said, Amory, is that just a hypothesis, or can you really do it? And he finally said, well, it's all on paper. It's a hypothesis. I said, okay. I said, I've got some research money. We're going to see if we can prove your hypothesis. Okay? I made him go on the advisory committee, and Art Rosenfeld is now commissioner of the CEC, was on, and Ralph Cavanna from the National Resources Defense Council, from UMass, was on the advisory committee. And we went ahead and said, okay, the hypothesis is, if we take a look at the energy supply for 15 years, and we do its present value, and we spend that much money, can we save 75% of the energy? Okay? And we did. We did it in houses, we did it in businesses, we did it in office buildings, we did it in all that. And it was, and the funny part was that there's an efficiency curve, which some of you may have seen, that the cheapest thing is to put better lights in. Then this, then you go through these measures, each one of them costs a little more. Well, there's a discontinuity in that curve. It turns out that you finally save so much energy that you need very little air conditioning. And so the size of the air conditioner goes down, and you save all that. And so you really can drive things. Every place we looked at, we got smart design teams, and frankly, architects and design teams are not well versed in how to do energy efficiency and designing buildings. And slowly they're growing them. Anywhere we went, we were able to save 68 to 85% of the energy use in any building. Okay? So the potential is there. Okay? We haven't gotten close to realizing it. The other thing, we talked briefly about distributed technologies. These are stuff that's small storage, energy efficiency, fuel cells, microturbines, photovoltaics, all of the information that is slowly creeping out into the system. What that means is that when you look at a system, you've got some general central generation, but you've also got stuff out into the system itself. And that you put generation out, you put efficiency out, you do power quality control. There's all kinds of ways to do this. There's a huge argument, a huge discussion going on nationwide now about this, because this totally upsets the paradigm of what's been the electric system. Because never, there's always a big central station, thousands of miles of transmission distribution line, the meter at your house. This now changes that whole concept, and there's real difficulty because all the rules are set up the other way. One of the rules that's big debate in this country right now is the so-called interconnection. How do you connect up to your local distribution wire? Utilities have basically been in control of that. Every utility has got a different set of rules. 3 years ago, if you said, I want to connect my wind turbine, and you went to PG&E, they would have given you a manual about that thick. And it would have been the one for the QFs, which are 50 to 100 megawatt thing. And they would have said that you're going to have a certified engineer, and you're going to have a lawyer look at this. And okay, now, so there's a huge battle going on right now. There's only really three states that have passed interconnection rules: Texas, New York, California. Okay, the rest of the country, there's probably a national meeting a week on this stuff. Okay, the technical guys are hammering out the technical rules. The IEEE, Institute of Electrical Engineers, and IEEE, I forgot what all the initials were for. Anyway, but this is the stuff that's beyond the technical. Okay, this is how much do you have to pay? What does it take? In some cases, the utility took 6 months to get somebody a permission, to do this stuff. I mean, it's hassle. The Arizona Public Power used to require that if you put a PV array on the roof, that you get $1 million home insurance policy to protect the grid. Like a 1 kW is going to bring the grid down. Okay, so there's a lot of because frankly this screws utilities up. They don't want this.
They're worried about the retro
fees. Well, it introduces harmonics. It does all. Most of the time, though, what you'll find out is that the systems go off because the grid harmonics are bad, not because these systems are bad. But I figure they come there. Basically, we're going in two directions. One I call plug and play, which says that if it meets all the technical standards, you plug it in and you tell somebody you've got it, and that's it. Okay? And the other one is hesitate and hassle, which is that even if you meet all the technical standards, you're going to have to hassle with the utility to get connected. Okay, and these two things are playing themselves out now on the national scene at the interconnection standards. And there's bills in Congress and all kinds of stuff. Now, the other thing is information. Okay, And you know, one of the, what, we used to have a chicken in every pot, and that was back in the, you know, the early 30s and 40s. And we have a car in every garage, or a computer in every school. Now we're going to have a chip in every appliance, right? So we're moving in the direction that basically we're going to be able to connect every appliance by wireless or wire or wireless, right? And the new Honeywell thermostats, for instance, that you buy, you can buy today, already have in them a wireless setup for you to talk to every appliance in your house if the appliance has a chip in it, okay? And there's already language available. You got Genie, you got Bluetooth, you got all kinds. Internet becomes a common carrier. So basically what it says is that we can move in the direction where, in essence, you should have a relatively simple program that can allow you to set when your appliances come on and off, and you can even key it into what the price is. And so that, you know, if it doesn't matter to you whether you wash at 4 in the afternoon or 10 o'clock at night, but the price is different, then you just set your machine to come on at 10 o'clock at night instead of doing it at 4 in the afternoon. Now, some of you may want to do it in the 4 in the afternoon. And I have to admit that several years ago when I told my wife that I was going to get her a solar dryer, she told me to go to hell. But I'm now buying a solar dryer. She's now decided that she's going to go back and hang the clothes on the clothesline, okay? So, but when you think of this stuff distributed, what we now have is we have a capability to control and manage all that. We never had that kind of capability, and that's what I think we're going to get to. Now, one of the things is that there's a theory in technology that's called radical and disruptive technology. And that means that it's technology that goes against the grain of what people have been doing. Okay? And one of the big examples, a guy by the name of Christensen from Harvard wrote the textbook on this thing. He studied the computer industry. He studied storage devices. He started out with, some of you may have been around long enough, with a 5 1/4 inch disk, okay? Then we went to the 3 1/2 inch, right? And now we're going to flash cards, and we're even going smaller, right? Okay. It turns out the companies who were the market leaders in the 5 1/4 inch disk never survived the shift to the 3 1/2 inch disk. And the companies who were the leaders in the 3 1/2 inch disk, none of them are the leaders in the flash cards. And he studied the shift from cable pulleys for construction equipment to hydraulics. It shifted different. So he has this theory of that there's, every now and then there's technology that comes along that's not evolutionary, but revolution. It's radical. It's disruptive. It takes apart the system that's been set up. All of this distributed stuff is against the way the utility system has been set up, the electrical system is set up. The other thing is the whole system is under total control of the power generator, of the power control operator at the power control center. Everybody for thousands of miles that's hooked up to that transmission line has to absolutely be in sync. 60 cycle, all the way down, all the way along the line. There is no way, in my own personal opinion, you can have an efficient marketplace and maintain that kind of control. It's not doable. And once you get distributed stuff in, there's no reason to do that, as a matter of fact. In fact, there's other ways of designing the system that doesn't require that, so that you can have distributed controls, distributed systems, that you can, for instance, if you want to have a blackout, instead of everybody totally blacking out, you can isolate an area, and the generation that's within that area can provide some of the power, so you don't have to go totally black. You can go gray. You can shut some stuff off. Okay? So there's other ways of designing these things that are there. Now, one of the things that does, however, one of the difficulties with that is the organizational structures never survive this kind of technological shift. So you can see why a utility that was good at using the old technology has real difficulty making the shift over to the new technology. This is what I ran into at PG&E because we did a lot of the early work on this distributed stuff. And I would go to my management and I'd say, hey, listen, you guys, you know, this distributed stuff is going to come along. We ought to begin to do it. The structure was set up to have big power plants, and it couldn't. The decision processes had been honed. The reason they were a good utility because they were using efficiently the technology of the day. A new technology comes along, all those decision processes went out the window. All the way you calculated return on capital, all the way you did, no longer fit. If you could, you could not run any of this stuff through the company's decision model. It didn't fit them. Couldn't get through it. Okay? And so I knew that something was going to happen to the utility industry. Because all the renewables, most of them, are dispatched by nature. Energy efficiency dispatches itself. All the distributed stuff is locally dispatched. Some guy sitting 1,000 miles away doesn't turn that stuff on and off. Mother Nature does it for wind, right? He has to respond to it. And if it's distributed, they can't handle it. The stuff's not there. So basically, there's a whole new organizational structure that's going to have to evolve, and I think we're in the process of doing that. And this is just for fun. I do a lot of scenario planning with Global Business Network. So I've looked at what are some of the scenarios for the electrical utility industry. And what I've done here is I've got the industry structure. And again, scenarios are not predictions of the future. They are postulating future worlds and then moving back from them. Okay, so you make up stories about a future world, and you make sure there's a logical sequence that you could achieve that, but you don't predict what it's going to be. The up and down axis is at the top. It's a regulated monopoly, very much regulated. Bottom, it's very much a market's operating, free, very much cutthroat competition. Across is a technological axis. On the left is that you've got still the big central power plants, nothing much else works out, that's the only thing that works. On the right, you've got the focus on being clean, you've got renewables, you've got the distributed power plants, you've got energy efficiency, you've got all this other new technology coming. Then when you divide the world up, you basically end up with four worlds, okay? You can decide that the industry is going to be regulated, and it's going to use all central station power plants. We're going to go back to the future, which is where we were, and that's what I call triumph of the good old boys. You go back to the old utility. And let's face it, there's lots of voices right now saying that we should go back to triumph of the good old worlds, right? The other one is that you have a competition situation set going on, but you don't have any really new technology in it, and I call that world new gladiators and old weapons, okay? And to some extent, that's what you have in California. You've got new gladiators. They're using the old weapons, and you don't have them under a heck of a lot of market control. They're just cutting you to pieces, right? So that you're in that world a little bit. The other one is that you do have all this new technology. You have totally restructured the utility, but you keep it regulated. But now you've got to get them to think different. You've got to get them to think differently, and I call that teaching old dogs new tricks. Okay? And it's not easy to teach old dogs new tricks. Some of them yap and bite, and, you know. it's tough. It's not easy, okay? And the other one is if you really do get this market all straightened out and you get the rules right, you can get to this, what I call, the supermarket of choices, where really you have, not only do you have some markets that operate well, but you have all of this new technology that moves in. Now, this is, and to some extent, all of these things are going on at the same time. What I see right now is a real focus on trying to make new gladiators and old weapons work. There's some people who are moving in the direction of teaching old dogs new tricks because they figure that the only way we're going to get clean technology and renewables into the whole mix of things is to force utilities back into being regulated and force them to buy them. And you'll see those kinds of things. And then there's some people who are trying to figure out how do we make the market go right so that this technological innovation enters that marketplace and gives you what you want. So this is sort of my view of trying to look in the big picture about where the world might be going. And if you think that that's all going to straighten itself out in the next year or two, forget it. Okay? And if you think that you're not going to end up paying for all of this in California, forget it. Because you are, whether as a taxpayer or as a consumer. Somebody is going to swallow the debt that's been accumulated. Whether you do it by bonds, whether you do it by taxes, by do it increased rates or whatever it is, that has to be taken off the books somehow, and you and I are the ones that are going to end up paying for it, whether we like it or not. Well, I'm going to quit. Time for a break.
Can we take a break and then?
Stan sent me an email recently. I thought it was very interesting, and it was about the possibility of lowering the electric grid by maybe 4 or 5
voltage.
The voltage for by about 4 or 5 volts.
Yeah. And it's the equivalent of putting like one or two or three power plants online without having to do it. You know, there's concerns that it might cause some problems with appliances, but other people say that, well, it's such a small change that it really wouldn't. What is your thought on that? And this is
you can reduce demand by lowering voltage. The problem with lowering... You can lower voltage and reduce demand. The question is, what does it affect? And most of the times it affects timing mechanisms. And so your clocks will run slower, and if you've got internal timers on stuff, it'll run slow. And some microprocessor systems are sensitive to lowered voltages, and they could kick off. And I don't know exactly what would happen or not happen. My guess is you most of the time the ISO tries to control the voltage with between 120 plus or minus 2 volts. Okay.
But most regular power supplies like you
have actually have a pretty high tolerance. They can take a 5 volt fluctuation.
What might be affected or not, I'm just not an expert in knowing what would be affected if you drop voltage.
In fact, the only thing that would be more damaging,
is the frequency, not the voltage. In other words,
if you change from 60 to 55 hertz, you really screw up a lot.
Exactly. Whereas the voltage, you can fluctuate 5 volts, and it's pretty nice.
Yeah. So most things probably, I don't know how sensitive some processors are to that. But my guess, if they're that sensitive, they had better be putting something in themselves to maintain that than for the grid. Because I personally think one of the things that's going to happen is that the reliability of the wire, that is your distribution wire, is going to have to be set at some level. And if you want reliability that's higher than that, you're going to have to pay for it. I got a letter about a year or so ago from the president of PG&E saying, hey, we're doing a wonderful job. I just put in all these extra distribution systems to all of the Silicon Valley facilities, you know, and we really want to keep reliable and good service. I wrote him back a letter and I said, well, you know, frankly, I don't know that that's a really good idea from my viewpoint, because the cost of that comes on my bill, because the cost of all those distribution wires gets distributed by all the users. If these guys really need that much kind of reliability, let them pay for it. Why should I pay for the reliability for Intel to increase their process? Let Intel pay for it. So you know, I think there's a certain level of reliability that's going to have to be sort of regulated into the distribution grid, and if you want it more than that, you're going to have to pay for it. And you know, if I'm a day trader, which there are probably not many more around anymore, then I would like a greater degree of reliability, right? So I'll buy myself a battery bank or something else. Now, there's technology out there for us to do that. So you can't expect all of the public to have a system that is 99.9999% reliable. There's going to be some level at which you're going to do it as a commodity. Yeah.
Going on with context for that issue, but how effective by doing something, you know, like grounding the power, what kind of effect do you have on prices? Because when the price has gone out of sight, yeah, that's obviously when you ground the power. But how effective can you really
to some extent, that's speculative right now. What's out there is at least a sense that if that you can shift the price 10 to 15% by a change of 1% in demand. So that is at the high levels, it's very sensitive to demand. So you can get tremendous price reductions for very little demand reduction when you're in those critical hours. Okay? Because those spikes, if you want, you can go on the ISO website and actually see the hourly spikes, and if you can cut some of those down, you really can do quite a bit on prices.
Here's more of a general kind of question, but clearly you have a pretty good grasp of all this, the complexity of this entire scenario. How much do you think you're being listened to by the right people? Do you think you have enough input that you tweak a few ears in the right direction, or do you think it's just hopeless in terms of what people are going to listen to versus what's going to happen? Or
well, I'll have to answer that question philosophically, okay? I'm at the age now where I'm no longer at the point where I think that I have to change the world. Okay? So I used to be there, but I'm not there anymore. So I try to input in a general sense, like talking to groups. I work with groups who have a bunch of people on them who are much more involved in the day-to-day business. And so many of the ideas that I talked about in distributed stuff, for instance, which I've written about and talked about for 10 years, are now being picked up and other people are using. So to some extent, I would say that my influence is much more like a college professor who's been teaching classes for a while than a consultant who's supposed to have a specific report on a specific problem today. Frankly, some of these things could consume me 24 hours a day. And I decided when I retired that I didn't want to play golf full time. I didn't want to garden full time. I do want to have some time with my grandchildren. I'll only do enough to keep me interested. And if people listen, great. And if they don't, I'm not going to lose any sleep over it. Many of my ideas have seeped into the system. The whole idea about interconnections and all of these things, that's been picked up. The whole idea of distributed generation has been picked up. Some of the other things that people are aware of these, they're pushing on some of it. I think the value that I sometimes bring is that I have both a technical and a policy background, and somehow I have the ability to put this stuff together.
Sure.
That seems to be my forte, you know?
And I'm leaning towards this policy part because I think the most important, the technical stuff, we're very much the same track of it. But the thing that was most relevant, in my opinion, was this whole idea of the good old boy network is very spotty.
No, seriously.
It's like I came from the U.S. government.
So oh, yeah.
It's painfully aware how difficult this is.
This radical stuff is tough.
So from a cultural infiltration perspective, to osmosify for these incredibly staunch, kind of rigid layers of bureaucracy, it gives us all things sort of churned up with like a
rotor. Let me just give you my own little experiences in that. You know, when I was at PG&E and we were beginning to talk about wind, and you know, wind comes on and the power control operator doesn't control it. So it's a real problem because power control operators don't like things that they can't control. They want a power plant to turn on when they tell them to turn on. If you say you're going to turn on tomorrow at 8, they want you to turn on tomorrow at 8, right? Absolute control philosophy. Okay, so here comes this wind, which comes on when Mother Nature says for it to come on, okay? So they really were fighting all the wind going into the Altamont. So I would sit down with these guys and I'd say, okay, what's the real problem, you know? And I'd say, look, what if wind was 1 cent a kilowatt hour and your bonus depended upon how much wind you could get into the system? What would you do? And they had all kinds of ideas of what they would do, okay? So it wasn't a technical problem. When we got all done with the discussion, I said, well, why aren't we doing that? And they said, it's a pain in the ass. Right? They come from a control mentality. They really don't like not being in control. And so you have a real cultural thing. In fact, when we did what I don't even know that the utilities are still using, what we call dynamic line transmission line management. Most transmission lines are designed to carry a certain amount of electricity. And the real technical limit from a thermal viewpoint, not loop flows and all, is when the internal core temperature of a wire reaches a certain temperature, it loses its ability, and over time it gets weak and all that kind of stuff. So you never want to exceed that temperature. Well, one way to guarantee that you never exceed that temperature is to assume that it's always 104 degrees F and there's no wind blowing, okay, no matter what it is. Okay, that way you know that you will never exceed that internal temperature on the transmission wire. Okay, well, we went out and we did a bunch of studies in terms of weather predictions and weather sites and instrumented transmission lines and found out what was the actual temperature and weather at places. You could put that in a computer program, which we did wind tunnel tests, and we always found out on hot days you never have zero wind because the ground convection current gives you a certain amount of wind flowing past anyway. So there's a lot more heat carried away than it's assumed. Well, we found out that there's a whole bunch of transmission lines that were never used more than 50% of the time. But they had this rigid limit on it. Okay, so then we said, well, why don't we manage these dynamically? Man, that was a real problem. We even had computer programs you could put in the line. It would give you a showing of how much it can carry under present weather conditions, how much it actually was carrying. You could do that. It took 3 years to get authority from the headquarters at PG&E for the local transmission operator to be able to sign off on a higher capacity limit than what was the limit in the book. Okay? Because it just went against the grain of the way things are set up.
So what I'm asking is, do you see a change now happening? Do you see this crustiness sort of breaking up a little bit?
No, not at the ISO.
Okay, so you were telling Charles mentioned the right people as a question. You know, that is another discussion. Who are the right people? The public will listen, and they will listen, and they will listen, and they will listen. They will buckle and drive me busy, but that's not necessarily the right people.
Well,
the right people would be the ones that listen to, hey, that makes sense.
Well, to some extent, you have to think about how people react to incentives, okay? Like in the UK, there's a transmission company that runs the transmission system for the United Kingdom. Okay? They're under a regime which, it's called revenue caps. Okay, basically it says that you can collect this much money over the year for running the transmission system. However efficient you run the system, you get to keep the difference between what it actually costs you and what you can collect. Okay? So if you run it more efficiently, you make more money. And if there's constraints in the system, and if you have to have what's called must-run plants in order to keep voltage up and all that, whatever extra it costs you to do that, you pay. Okay? Because we have all kinds of problems in California with transmission constraints and with all this kind of stuff. I talked to the head of the UK transmission company, and I said, geez, you know, under that kind of a regime, you've got some real problems with your operators because it means they have to be much more flexible in what they do and so on. He says, yeah, we never want a must-run plant because he gets top price, and he can sit there and not even generate, and we have to pay him. And we don't want transmission constraints, because if the prices go up on the transmission, we eat it off our profits. I said, well, what did it take? He said, I met with dispatchers and operators for almost 6 months before they finally got the idea. And you know, all of a sudden, we don't have must-run plants anymore. We don't have very little in transmission constraint. We shift stuff around. We built a DC line, which we switch back and forth. We give incentives for power plants to locate in certain places, which makes our transmission easier, because we make more profit the more efficiently we run the system. We don't run it efficiently, it costs us more, we eat it. And so it's here, all that stuff gets passed on to the consumer. The ISO doesn't matter to him.
Seems to me that the wheel would be a perfect solution to the irregularity of the wind patterns. You have
the vertical wind turbines?
A vertical concrete spinning wheel.
It didn't work. Basically, it's a bearing problem.
Yes. Yes.
Well, it turned out that...
When you said, that's really your big Boeing signals with the unit that...
That was a transmission bearing transmission problem. Basically, you've got a lot of stress in the house, but that got taken care of. There's some designs that take care of that.
Well, also the speed and
My department was very much involved in that one. In fact, we had several people who cried when the dynamite charges toppled it because they spent a lot of that time.
It was the bearing problems on the
It's shaft bearings and transmission problems.
See, if you look out across all the way towards Napa, I live on top of the
Well, you get some wind out there.
I get lots of wind. Now, it occurred to me as you were talking in your paradigms here, that a third solution is something that I'm getting ready to do, is that one, I stay on the regular grid, and then I have an alternate grid, and I go back and forth as I wish. And the battery, I have a couple of dozen batteries, deep cycle batteries. If I get into real power storage, I have got inverters, and I just use that to run my regular 120.
Yeah, well, essentially the...
But I don't stay on it, so I don't have to get into the utility enterprise business, because I was paranoid enough to...
Okay, but the interconnection problem with PG&E, under the new rules,
yeah,
you ought to be able to have a relatively simple interconnect, and the new inverters all have the cutoff. That is, if the grid drops, it cuts you off and you can operate independently. When the grid comes back on, it hooks you back in. So all of that's been automated, and all of that's become a lot simpler than the old days.
We have plug-and-play capacity, and the regulations still allow for plug-and-play, what you're saying.
That's correct. It's still not simple, but at least the regulations say you should be allowed to do it.
I didn't trust the government in that case of a crisis that they would confiscate them, because under Presidential Act number 1, they can confiscate the private energy sources, and I did not wish my...
Well, if that happens, it wouldn't matter whether you're connected to the grid or not.
Why not?
If they want to grab your private energy sources, they're going to grab your private energy sources. Whether they're connected to the grid or not, it won't matter. Huh?
I do want to ask a technical question, though, about the NVIDIA types, the spherical ones.
Yeah.
What's your opinion of those?
Those are the ones that really have problems. Bearings.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Bearings, that and the pinning of the blade, because that blade vibrates, and that pin, it would snap.
It would snap off, because with virtue of those, you can catch them from any direction.
Yeah. It turned out that the other technology moved ahead of it. Now, they're going to communicate it back to it. The Canadians don't have a big program going in that. But the other was that you had all the weight of that thing sitting on the bearing system. And that bearing system, I thought they were going to really be the technical winner, because maintenance is easier, or right, stuff is. It just didn't turn out that way.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's sort of
egg beater.
Egg beater thing,
yeah.
And you said the Canadians
still
have a program.
The Canadians are still looking at it.
Okay. They're nice to look at. The small turbines that I have to be mounted on the side of a barn or a house or...
Most of the small stuff is on tilt-up poles.
Yeah, right. One person can do it. It would pertain to your rectum, but, you know, your system is up. And they go on ocean-going sailboats 6 months at sea without problems. And inspection once a year to see the LED lights on.
Yeah, and the new stuff actually has got some telemetering things in it and all that. You know, yeah, they're very reliable. The only problem is that you can't, in urban areas, you've got real problems with them, because in most cases you have ordinances that don't allow you to stick a pole 20, 30 feet in the air with a wind turbine on top. And so that addresses, but in ranch country, man, I don't know anybody in California in ranch country, but particularly because the new ones are also eligible for a 50% rebate from the California Energy Commission.
They're quiet, too.
I asked the supervisors about that, and they said there is no ordinance that prohibits you to put a windmill on your house here in the San Francisco district.
Sure. Depends on the style. Depends on the area. My guess is it's unincorporated and if not. If you want to put one up in Blackhawk, I know there is. If you want to put one in San Francisco, I know there's an ordinance against it in Walnut Creek.
Is Blackhawk, Nevada? Or
Blackhawk out in the Walnut Creek there. The low income home in Blackhawk is $1.5
million. So you can have a stove.
You can't even hang your clothes out on a clothesline in Blackhawk.
You can have a sleeping pod. It's cold at night, you know, and then you kind of come back out.
Yeah. Frankly, if you're a homeowner in an urban area, even though it may be cheaper to go for wind turbine problems that it gets you in terms of neighbors and everything else, you're better to put a flat panel PV thing on your roof.
Yeah. You know, this whole plug and play thing, it really strikes me, it reminds me of what happened with the phone industry.
Yes.
Remember the days when if you wanted to put an answering machine on your telephone, you had to have a special interconnect box.
That's right. Bob Bell wouldn't let you put that on, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Unless you have their answering machine.
Yeah.
So,
The thought at one time was that if you did not control the actual design and everything on that telephone, you should not be able to connect to the client. That was broken up for the telecommunications industry breakout, because that concept went out the door. Other people could make phones. Otherwise, Western Bell or Western Pacific, they made all the telephones with packed Bell. I mean, for Ma Bell in those days.
Is there something that we can learn from what happened with the deregulation of the telephone industry that would help us better handle the deregulation?
Well, there's some things similar and a lot of things different. The amount of current that has to flow is altogether different. Okay? You can learn from the fact that all kinds of people can make things and hook them to a network, and if the rules are right, it's okay. That seems to work all right. You certainly can learn from the fact that by doing that, you get some innovation in, and that my guess is there'd be unbelievable innovation if you can do plug and play on kind of smaller devices. So people will think of stuff to do that none of us can think of. So, yeah, there are some things that you can learn. A lot of people have used that corollary to try to work. But the other thing I want to remind you of, that even though the breakup of the telecommunications industry has been now 12 years, we're still not settled out. And this breakup of the airplane industry has been 15 years or more, and it's still not settled out. Okay, so these things are not, it isn't that you go bang one day to the next, okay? One thing, I keep hating to think that everything's going to take this long, but the data tells me that it isn't easy to shift a whole technological system from one kind of a mold to another kind of mold.
Yeah, but that's technology. That could be a finite number, but the cultural aspect.
Well, again, I use technology. There's a very interesting book written by a guy named Thomas Hughes who talks about technical systems. And to him, a technical system is not only the technology, but all of the infrastructure and the people and the training that are involved in that. Okay, you can shift the technology, but the rest of the technological system is much slower to shift. The way that you make profits, the way you do this, the way you do capitalization, the way you do designs, all those things have to shift when that system shifts. And that's one of the reasons why if you have a big technological shift, often the old companies can't make that shift. It's not because they can't deal with the technology. They can't deal with all the surrounding stuff that goes with it. Yes, ma'am?
This is the stuff that by the time they get around to this, it'll be the year 5,000.
What is it?
It's a Tesla technology.
Oh, okay.
Tesla's a real thing.
Well, Tesla's thought of having this force basically out there, being able to collect it anywhere, is the ultimate distributed system.
Yeah.
In fact, there was years ago, I used to read a lot of science fiction. Okay. Now I just live it, but I remember vividly this story, and I've been trying to find it in the science fiction literature, and I've not been successful. But the story was this: that they had squeezed down nuclear power plants to the point of the size of a bowling ball, and it was an infinite power source. And that when you got to be 21, the government gave you one of these. Okay, and so that was the hypothesis. And then the guy constructed the story about what would happen to society. Okay, because first of all, you would redesign your cars and all that, because basically all you would want is a place to put your bowling ball, right? Your little nuclear reactor. And if you got a family together, then if you shared them, you had four or five of them, right? And so the whole structure of how the energy system worked totally changed the way society operated. And to some extent, when you think of ultimate distributed stuff, if you think of Tesla and his idea of the forces out there that you could capture anywhere, this is the ultimate distributed thing. And basically you have access now to energy any place, anytime, anywhere you want. And if you just think about what that would do to the social structure and the whole structure we have, it's mind-boggling.
That the transmission lines that PG&E has have suffered for lack of maintenance? Are they actually in bad shape? Do you know?
I can't answer that from personal data, okay? I can answer it from the point of view that maintenance on the transmission system has been minimal, okay? And so that I only look at that by being able to see the dollars spent on transmission maintenance. So, and clearly there has not been any big maintenance on transmission because nobody knew where the money was going to come from and who was going to pay for that. Okay.
Yeah, so, you can forestall a certain amount of that maintenance.
That's right. You can forestall maintenance for some time. Yeah. Yeah. So the statement I would make is that the level of maintenance of the transmission system over the last 4 or 5 years has probably not been as good as it was for previous years. Okay, but I don't know any, personal, any personal knowledge.
We have to entertain 2 more questions because it's getting past 5 o'clock. We should be out here by 5:30 in terms of two questions.
Do you have solar on your home?
I do not. I have had an order in for almost 8 months. And it turns out that it's with a company that the guy used to work for me. Is the vice president of, and every time it gets close to putting one on my house, he's got another one sale, and he says, wouldn't you wait? Even his own house, the system was in his garage, ready to be installed when he had another sale, and it went out for somebody else. So I told him, I said, look, I can wait. You get your customers, get it moving, and
solar installation is a growth industry, would you say then?
In California, it's booming. In fact, the concern that I have is that the skill of the infrastructure is not there yet, and that you're going to see a whole bunch of guys jump into this game, and they're going to charge all kinds of things, and they're not going to be certified. Well, it's like the old days of solar hot water heating, if you can think back that far, okay? And my concern is that if the industry isn't careful about that. And if the CEC in terms of its rebate program doesn't stick in some very tight rules in terms of the skill level of companies who apply for rebates and so on, that we're liable to have a real bad product history appear. That worries me.
One of the main problems will be with fuses and charge controllers.
The inverters and stuff have always been a problem. Yeah. And the other horror scenario that I keep thinking of, because I'm in scenario planning, so I always try to think of what's the wild cards that can happen, Here the state signs all these long-term contracts. The prices drop. Okay. Now everybody stays. We get more efficient, so on, demand goes down. So all of a sudden they've got all these contracts they've bought, which are take or pay. Okay, you either take it or you pay it anyway. So all of a sudden, they've got this excess contract that if you don't take them, they're going to have to eat that money. Where's that going to come from? So I can see these ads now where the state of California is asking you to keep your lights on at night so that they can fulfill their contracts that they've signed. Okay? And instead of telling you to save, they're going to tell you to use in order to pay off the bonds that paid for the contract. Well, why would anybody renegotiate? Well, they should just be careful what they deal, what they're signing, and what they put in place.
Contract values weren't very good, especially with the ones were tied in. The PG&E didn't pay them; they still had to keep producing. There should have been a clause in there. If you don't get paid, they can sell their product elsewhere.
Yeah. I'm only very peripherally familiar with that. Yeah, in terms that was an early development that included photovoltaics, but actually included solar hot water heating only. It did not include photovoltaics. And I know of several communities and several builders who are offering houses with integrated photovoltaics and solar hot water heater now. One in Sacramento and one in San Diego.
Part of the Southampton development in Indonesia. Because I saw those out there earlier
when I had
the
this was 1970s,
hot water heaters. up on the roof.
Yeah, someone put it. But there is a community housing development also in Benicia where 15 homeowners got together. They're doing one of these. This is not community housing as you usually think of. Each of them has an individual house, but they have commons to it, and they developed it as one development. Each one of those houses are going to have photovoltaics on it. They're all interconnected, and they do their own thing. So I'm kind of watching that one to see what kind of happens as those houses get occupied and used. But even the thing I showed around, the Don Bradley house, it's integrated photovoltaics and so on.
What was the date on that paper on the Don Bradley
house? That was today's paper. Today's Contra Costa Times. This is June 10th, Contra Costa Times.
Have you ever given this kind of presentation to our board of supervisors?
I have not given a presentation like this to the board of supervisors. Several reasons. One is board of supervisors don't sit for this much time. The other, I have given a presentation of what I thought the problems were in California to the city council of the city of San Jose. I did that in a 40-minute kind of presentation. Okay.
Like with that kind of situation, these people, unless they're really schooled in the energy industry, you can't condense the information enough for their time spent and their consciousness, their attention, so that somebody who is an adversary for their own private reasons couldn't shoot holes in whatever you were saying because they can only pull up other data that
right? Well, you have to condense it way down and kind of basically say 1, 2, 3. Here's the 10 things, or so on and so forth. But you can condense some of it down, pretty much. There's a lot. I had time with you guys to go into some of the background and things that some people don't sit and listen to.
The whole story.
Nobody ever hears the whole story. Like, nobody ever knows the whole truth, right?